Welcome to TC Daily, the technology show brought to you by Tech Central. If you haven't subscribed yet, do so at youtube.com/TechCentral and subscribe to our daily newsletter. You can do that at techcentral.co.za/newsletter. Now, very pleased to welcome my next guest in the studio, and that's Keith Pitu. Keith is CTO at Indigo Broadband and an expert in South Africa on everything TV white spaces. And we're going to get into some detail about exactly what TV white spaces are and why they're exciting and connecting rural areas. But it's great to see you, Keith. Thanks for making the time to come in.
Well, thanks very much for the invite, and great I could pop in while I'm up here. And good to see you again. It's been almost 3 years now.
It's been a long time. I'm catching up with a lot of people lately who I haven't seen for a long time because of COVID.
Yeah, I think 2 years disappeared. We don't know where it's gone.
Yeah.
But no, it's lovely. Thanks for the invite, and great to have a chat.
Great. Well, let's talk about TV white spaces. We're going to talk a bit about, well, we're going to go all over the place, I think, in this conversation. But I think as a starting point for anyone who doesn't know what TV white spaces are, let's define it.
Okay.
What is it exactly? How long has it been around? Who came up with the idea? What does it promise?
Yeah. Look, TV white space, as they call it, it's actually the open channels between the TV, analog TV transmissions. And it operates from the lower end of the spectrum in which is allowed for TV broadcasting between 470 megahertz. In Europe, it goes up to 790, but here in South Africa, we go up to 698 megahertz. So that is the allocated spectrum for analog TV. So the concept came up because of getting into rural areas. It was actually originally done at Strathclyde University in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Where they wanted to try and connect people over the terrain and difficult areas and get a little bit further. So they found that they could use this lower frequency to get a little bit further where you're not obstructed by physical objects, et cetera, and the terrain, and also undulating terrain.
So the frequencies we're talking about here tend to go through objects and penetrate further in the landscape.
Correct, yes.
Which is why your television signal, or analog television signal, tends to be quite good.
Exactly.
Right. So we're talking about, and I think only older viewers to this, or listeners to the show will remember this, but if you were to tune an old TV, you used to turn the knob.
And you'd get your...
You get all the snow.
The snow, correct, yes.
Between the channels. Now, it's the snow that you're using for TV white spaces broadband.
Correct. So... Okay. Basically, it's then to you coexist with existing TV channels, and TV white space is the secondary operator where the TV broadcasters are primary, mm-hmm. And it's making use of that unused spectrum, because if you look around at the plan of most TV broadcasters in certain areas, they're only using, depending on how many channels on the TV there are, but here in South Africa, on an average, 4, maybe 5 channels per geographic area out of 37 channels. Mm-hmm. So you're leaving it with a lot of unused spectrum, and that's where it came about. But particularly because of the lower frequency, you can reach further into the rural areas because of your terrain, where you're not hindered by trees and obstructions. You know, in many parts in Africa, a lot of the things like mango trees, etc., are high foliage, but it progresses through that, so it's not obstructed by that. Similar to the higher, you know, the above 1 gig frequencies. So that is what made it attractive. But then they went into digital radio. So you've got cognitive radio, which is building a bit more intelligence into it all. And part of the regulations, I mean, they started with this concept early on, and initial trials were done in 2011, 2012, 2013. I was involved in the ones in Kenya, but they also did them here in Cape Town, in Limpopo, and Cape Town and Limpopo.
I remember those projects. Microsoft and Google were
Microsoft and Google sponsored most of the beginning. Microsoft for Africa was part of them, and then Google were involved. And they promoted the concept and also helped fund the developers of the products. And what it was found, and with a bit of research work, the successful report, particularly from Cape Town, where they connected, I think, about 10 schools in the early years from Tigerberg, and that... The TV white space could coexist next door to a TV channel without interference.
Right.
And that opened up the door. And actually, that also helped them regulate it so that you could coexist on adjacent channels. You didn't have to have a separation of two channels, which made a big difference. So that progressed. It took quite a while for regulators to actually get through and produce the regulations. In South Africa, the UK was the first, and then America and Canada. And here in SA, it was first, the technical regulations were produced in 2018.
Okay.
But then there was the challenge, because part of TV white space operations for an operator is it operates, the base station operates off a spectrum database, which then tells them which TV channels are being used by the broadcasters that you then cannot use.
Mm-hmm. And this is by geographic area, is it?
It's called a geographic spectrum database. Mm-hmm. So there's a primary database which is actually controlled by the regulator, ICASA, and that is fed by the Centex and the SABC of what channels are being used in which area according to their frequency plan.
And this is all to avoid interference. You don't want interference with the TV broadcasters
or with each
or
other.
Vice versa.
Yeah. And if you've got multiple operators in the area, it will tell you which channels are being used. You can't use those. So it shows it to you. It's an automatic process. So originally the specification for those channels was developed in the UK by Spectrum Bridge, America and the UK, and then one of the others that came into it. It's called PAWS. The acronym misses me, but it's the definition of how the spectrum database should operate. And basically, the secondary spectrum database allows the base station to log in, verifies your credentials. It's based on a GPS location built into the base station, and that then will determine what channels are available to you to use in that area. And you can see the channels that are blocked out, mm-hmm. That are not available. So that's the principle and the concept, whether it's multiple users or the TV broadcasters. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely an opportunity, and it's been growing. I call TV white space the 4x4 of broadband, mm-hmm. mainly because it gets you that much further into the bush, but not necessarily at the same high speed.
Right.
So you've got the reach, you've got the connectivity. But obviously, because of the lower spectrum, the lower frequency using, and the channels in the ETSI zone, which we are 8 megahertz channels. Mm-hmm. America's 6 megahertz TV channels. So we've got a little bit more, but you can only do so much with an 8 megahertz channel.
What about digital TV? Because Centex has been running digital TV they call it dual illumination.
Yeah.
They've been running both analog and digital broadcasts for many years, and hopefully we'll be switching off those analog signals at some point soon. But I presume that TV broadcasters are using a lot more spectrum at the moment because of the fact that there is this dual illumination going on.
Yes.
Does that still leave sufficient spectrum to do TV white spaces?
It does leave. We have noticed whether the database is up to date. We have noticed sometimes some unknown transmissions which we've fed back and reported when we've done a spectrum scan. Also, digital TV uses a lot less channel spectrum than the analog does, because you can get a lot more out of that 8 megahertz channel with your digital TV than you can.
Do you still have the spaces between digital channels? And if so,
yes,
yeah. you do. Okay, so you can still use TV white spaces, still makes sense in an entirely digital TV broadcasting world. Okay.
Now, that is the whole plan, and also to get out of that analog, because the digital TV is far more efficient in the use of the channels. Mm-hmm. So that's what's taken the longest, but it hasn't affected TV white space deployment as such. It's I think the biggest challenge in TV white space is there have been quite a few vendors, been in the game for quite a few years.
Yeah.
I mean, you've had Adaptrum, you've got Redline, you've got Radwin, Carlson Wireless, of which we are their partners in Africa. And now you've got others from Korea and Singapore called Internet, and there's a place called WizSpace. But it's all coming about for rural broadband, it needs to be a point-to-multipoint fixed wireless network to get out and stretch into those areas where you can, from the point of a subscriber unit or a CPE, as we always call them, then establish a connectivity zone around that.
Mm.
To make it more cost-effective. But the challenge, it has been the growth and the demand, but because it's still mass to market with expenses and cost.
Yeah.
So your CPE is still not into the Wi-Fi or the 5 gigahertz because it's such a big market.
CPE being consumer
premises equipment.
The piece of equipment you need to receive the signals.
That receives from the base station to a subscriber unit, as they call it in the States, or... Yeah, most people call it the CPE.
Right.
But as a result, so one looks at what's the best way of using this technology to reach into areas where your standard 5 gig doesn't,
mm.
or your 2.4, because your point-to-multipoint in the most open spectrum is 5 gig mostly. But as I said, you do some of the vendors try to do channel bonding and channel aggregation using multiples of the 8 megahertz to get a higher throughput.
Mm-hmm.
What Carlson did was put three radios into one base station, so that you've got a 360 degree. But then you're still limited to maximum about 30 megs per second over an 8 megahertz channel.
Right.
So it does provide you with a limitation, but the fact that it's symmetrical data and not asymmetrical is a much higher throughput and a much higher efficiency of the channel usage.
Right. So what are you getting with TV white spaces that you wouldn't be able to get with a cellular network?
Basically, at the end of the day, you're trying to provide a Wi-Fi connectivity at the end of it instead of cellular. Mm-hmm. But it's really just basically another fixed point-to-multipoint.
Is it fixed much wireless. Cheaper to do?
Is that the advantage? It's not really that much cheaper at the moment. It's just, as I said, you can get further.
Right.
So you don't need to have that many base stations or high sites.
Okay.
So you can get past your line of sight approach. They call it near line of sight. So you can go over the hill or through trees.
Right.
Even if it's, and we've had quite a few where there's been serious obstructions, but you actually get through it.
Mm. Because of the nature of the lower frequency.
That's right. So hence my comment of calling it the 4x4 of broadband.
Is this particularly suited for rural deployments, or can it be deployed in cities as well?
We've tested it in cities. There's a lot more TV spectrum usage in the cities because of repeaters, etc. It's very much more for rural, where you've got your undulating terrain, etc. I think we've got to acknowledge now in cities, it's high demand spectrum, it's high capacity, high throughput. So everything's going into your Wi-Fi 6 and even your 60 gigs.
Mm-hmm.
In those sort of environments, because if you're going wireless, they want something similar to fiber, so you've got to have that capacity. Whereas in the rural areas, you've got to reach out into areas that are difficult to get to. There's no infrastructure. TV white space is very easily powered by solar, not high demand. So it's very easy to create. Your base station consumption is not high, and to put in solar kits, which is what we've done in these rural areas, particularly the subscriber unit with the Wi-Fi access point is all solar-powered.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily enough, these guys don't have any break in internet when they have load shedding. And
so that's both the base station and the CPE equipment.
We've used the base station, not so much solar. We've actually put in a UPS in the base station, which is big enough because they've got AC power there, and it's normally co-located with a mobile network possibly.
Ah.
So it's normally got a priority as far as power is concerned or a generator there. So one looks at it, but we have considered solar in areas where there isn't.
Yes.
And, I mean, to power a TV white space base station with a router and other things that you might need, a microwave link to the site, you may be looking at about 70 watts that you need, so it's nothing big. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maximum 100 watts, power of all your different features. You can add security cameras. So it's easily to solar power a TV white space base station.
Oh.
The subscriber unit, we've perfected that, where it's a plug and forget. It works. It doesn't. Difficult to switch it off, actually. but that's why I call it, when you're maintaining these networks, it's for one man with a ladder.
Right.
He doesn't have, his dog can follow him, but it's one man a ladder because, to power down or take it loose, you just got to climb up a pole.
What sort of coverage are you getting around a base station? What sort of distances are we looking at?
Well, the base station, you're getting up to, in most cases, we're conservative. We say 10 kilometers,
mm-hmm.
And that's depending on the terrain, the propagation. But in some cases, you can get 15. Obviously, the further you go out, the bit of degradation in your throughput. But we tend to work on normally a radius of 10 kilometers relative to the terrain. We've seen better, but I think it's all applicable depending on your RF propagation prediction, because wherever we go, we first do a proper prediction of the RF in that area from the particular point. And then we, from the point to multipoint, that's where we put down the Wi-Fi hotspots and provide 150 to 200 meter radius from that point.
Can you just pump up the power on the base station to get a better...
Unfortunately, I wish we could. I wish the regulators would allow us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that is one of the challenges, because TV white space is limited in its power based on the area that you're in.
Okay.
The total EIRP you're allowed is 41 dBm, which is not much in comparison. So it would be great if one could, and there's been a lot of push to try and get higher power TV One space. Obviously, also, you've got to think of the dissipation of heat within your radios, within your unit. But as it's progressing, we're seeing a much better performance, in the radio performances. So like with everything, you know, it's once you get it into the field and you get the feedback, it doesn't help just doing it in a lab. We've had some excellent field trials, not trials, but functional operational networks.
And at the edge of the network coverage area, is the speed you get slower than closer to the tower, or is it?
It is a bit slower, but we've had 15 megabits per second at 12 kilometers.
Okay.
So, yeah, it depends, you know. And as I said, you know, it's symmetrical data, so you're tending to get a lot more efficiency. And in most of those cases, the usage is devices, mobile or tablet devices. So you're not permanently connected. When you're streaming, et cetera, it works well. It works very well with video calls, as was shown in the early days, actually, with the trials when we did it in Kenya. So it is applicable, but as I said, it's not the silver bullet, as some people would think it is. But it does clear you. You get the 5 gig radius, and then you get the TV white space, which is a little bit further out. And that's why I still call it the 4x4. It can get you connecting to people on an economical basis without having to extend your network. Once you create the connectivity and the demand and the subscribers connecting, then you can motivate to actually add more sites in the area.
I don't think it applies to LTE. I could be wrong, but certainly in older cellular networks, if you added more devices to the network, the size of the cell shrank.
Yes.
Shrank. and so people at the edge would lose connectivity. Does the same thing happen in TV wide spaces?
Not really, no. It's I think basically what you found, as you said, yeah, with the LTE from your 2G, 3G, and 4G, obviously as your frequency went up, you had to create more base stations because your propagation reduced. So, a lot of people, because the battle in the cellular industry was going from 900 megs to 1800 was still all right, but then going to 21 and 2700, it made a big difference. And if you're putting those base stations on the same towers as your older technology, you need to create more to fill in the gaps because your propagation at those frequencies is a lot less, particularly in high-density areas where you've got a lot of obstructions. TV white space handles reflections very well, which is so you'll get a bounce off it, and that's where the cognitive, the smart radio comes in.
I was going to ask about, you mentioned cognitive at the beginning of the discussion, cognitive radio. What is it exactly? How does it work? Is this a clever way of figuring out what spectrum is available in a particular area?
Not particularly. That is coming. Some of the vendors are putting in, with the GPS there, the problem is the database is not dynamic at the moment. There's been a lot of discussion about creating dynamic channel allocation so that if it picks up interference, and some of the vendors did work on that, saying, hang on, I'll request another channel from the database, which can be done. But it requires interaction also with the database operator and to set that up. But yes, you can sense if I've got noise or interference from something else I don't know about. At the moment, basically, they manage that and monitor it and get your low noise amplifiers, et cetera, to look at what can they limit around there. And if you are picking up interference, that one actually notifies the spectrum database to block that channel out, which is what I've done. I've done it a couple of times.
Right. So dynamic database is not on the table right now in South Africa.
Well, I think there's a lot of discussion, you know, as part of the DSA, Dynamic Spectrum Alliance. They'd love to see dynamic spectrum allocation, and not only in TV white space, but I think the concept of how can we use this dynamic spectrum usage amongst higher channels and mobile networks. And there's always been discussions on it, but it's a difficult one to push when people own spectrum.
Because there's a lot of wastage in spectrum, isn't there? I mean,
there's a lot of unused spectrum.
And amongst the mobile operators, they're not using all of it all over the country.
Well, the thing is, once somebody buys spectrum, and I've spoken about spectrum sharing or people lease out their spectrum, like we know quite a few of the mobile operators do, but if you've got spectrum over a geographic area or it's specific to a geographic area, it suits some, but it doesn't suit the others. So it's I personally think it would be great, but there's too much invested into that. I mean, look at the price what they pay for buying a spectrum. Yeah. So You don't want to give that away.
Now, the CSIR has been quite involved in all of this.
Oh, very much so, yes.
Just tell us a bit about their role and what they've contributed to this process.
Well, I think the CSIR is a very big player in TV white space, and they are very much at the moment pushing it because they're the ones who developed the local spectrum database, mm-hmm. The secondary geolocation spectrum database, as it's called. And they've called it the spectrum switch, which accommodated the ICASA-specific requirements for South Africa. There was some difference to the international PAWS requirements. And not only that, they are pioneering, and they did with the first phase where UNDP funded 4 pilot projects in 4 different areas for SMME ISPs. And those projects were set up and got going and were quite, you know, successful. Using a similar concept also with the solar-powered CPEs. And there's a phase 2 going through the process at the moment where it's funded by the UK and one or two others, I can't remember which, but daily involved in. Mm-hmm. And very much there's a very interesting TV white space WhatsApp group for Africa with a lot of the regulators and country people and everybody sharing what's happening in the various countries, and it's a
so there's quite a lot of activity going on.
There is a lot of activity, mainly to try and get regulators to accept it and go forward. A lot of activity in Tanzania and discussions at the moment. Kenya is fully regulated with their database, but I think the challenge, being at the end of the day, is you know, a lot of people say, "Oh, can I get, you know, 1 gig out there?" I said, "Well, if they've got nothing at the moment, you know, 30 megs or something is better than nothing." Mm. Which is where we started with in cellular in the beginning. So create the connectivity, create the demand and the growth, and you'll be able to fund the supplementary expansion of your network.
So you say Kenya is fully regulated now. Is South Africa fully regulated?
Yes, South Africa is fully regulated. Commercially, the database was available, I think, on the 1st of April 2021.
Okay. And is the CSIR still operating?
CSIR there? Still operated. There was a discussion that they were going to white label it out to a database operator. Yes. That hasn't happened yet. I know they put a tender out, but I think that's all stationary. And the CSIR are actively marketing their database to other African countries to help regulators and to help others so that you know they can give a typically African experience of what's about, but they're quite happy to go into various others. In Kenya, they use the database from the UK, and then they adapted it to the Kenyan environment.
Okay. Yeah. And our regulations here that were developed by ICASA, are they good? Are they fit
yes,
for purpose?
Yes, no, they're fit for purpose, yeah. And they're very reasonable. There's nothing unreasonable about them. Some of the spectrum database operators were not too keen to change their standard spec to adopt to the South African ones, and hence they haven't come into the game. But the CSIR have done a very good job of what they're doing.
Okay.
And they're very, very passionate about connecting the unconnected and TV white space. Mm. And some of my good friends are based there in the CSIR. We get on very well with each other.
Okay. Good to hear. So, Heath, now that the regulation is in place, and I know a lot of potential operators, people who wanted to roll out projects, were waiting for these regulations to come into force, for the database to be ready and operational, which it now is. What are we seeing in terms of commercial deployments on the ground, and where are these typically happening right now?
Well, I think commercial, besides the funders or donations from organizations like UNDP, et cetera, we've only really got 2 operational networks, and they're both up in Louis Trichardt, strangely.
Okay.
Where they've kicked off, and you know, they've got 12 CPEs in one and 8 in the other, and creating the hotspots and selling vouchers and, you know, getting up connectivity. The biggest challenge for any individual network operator is raising that initial capital to get the network going. And it's very difficult for a new ISP or an SMME for 2 reasons. One is if they want to raise the money, and in most cases, the small project, 1.5 million, it can adequately get you going. Mm-hmm. And you can serve easily, you know, 1,000 people, if not more, with that, and have a nomadic Wi-Fi network around your area. But they're either, from a local point of view of funding, they're wanting a lot of commitment from it and high return repayments, et cetera, to get the guys going. Or else it's a lot too small for the funders or people raising funds. You know, they want something like $1 million. I mean, I can roll out at least 8 networks with that sort of money. And that is a challenge. We've got a lot of them, and they've tried IDC, they've tried USASA, they've tried everybody. And it's such a pity because there are a lot of very keen, interested ISPs and SMMEs who want to build community-based networks that are, they're not non-profit. They need to be a viable proposition and sustainable network operators. And we are happy to, which we've done, to help incubate these guys and provide them with the platform for billing, for network management, and with the solutions and help them design their network, which is what we do.
Okay. So two in the Louis Trichardt area. I know there was some talk a while ago about some projects in Eastern Cape. There was, I think, in the old Transkei, there was some pilot project running in KZN. Have those all fallen by the wayside? Are those still on the go?
No. Well, as far as I know, the original project that was funded by the USTDA, and that was with WAPA and Isizwe, and there was some in the KwaZulu-Natal, and there was actually also one up in Louis Trichardt was done up there. So they, as far as I understand, they're still running. Mm. And there is some interest amongst others, a lot of operators. But as I said, the biggest challenge is getting that startup funding.
Yeah.
I think I've got at the moment about 5-6 projects that I've planned and prepped and put together and provided them with the costings, and it's just taking time for them to get funded. Which
it's kind of sad, really.
It's very sad. No, it's very sad. When you think of what is available from the original Universal Service Fund, USASA, and CETA, and all that sort of stuff, but it's just not happening. I'm not getting to the right people. So
this seems like an obvious thing for the Universal Service Fund.
It is an obvious thing because the original establishment, and Ghana has done something very well with the Universal Service Fund, where they've rolled out infrastructure and provided the capex to build infrastructure for rural communities to build the network, because that's the main obstacle, is putting that initial capex in.
Mm.
Because really, at the end of the day, once that's up and built, it's up to them to just sell vouchers and sell airtime.
Yes.
And maintain the network, which you try and keep very low.
Mm.
So, and you incubate them on how to do that, how to get out there, how to market, and also provide them with a technical training and upliftment. And it's amazing what the one crowd in Louis Trichardt have done. They've really embraced it, where they've learnt. And they're very, I would say, largely self-sufficient to a large degree. And we just connect with them remotely when we need to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So very interesting. Yeah. I'd love to see a lot more of it. White space or any point to multipoint fixed wireless, and creating the connectivity through a mixture of either in-house or hotspot scenarios.
Right, right.
And
what are you seeing in these two scenarios at the moment? Are you seeing entrepreneurs creating Wi-Fi hotspots off based on this connectivity? Are you actually seeing people deploying the CPEs in their homes?
No, we're seeing a lot more of the hotspots creations, because one hotspot covers
a lot of people.
A lot of people.
And then it would be a spaza shop operator, for example, who might
even a home.
They put
them in the backyard of a home.
Oh, right.
And you'll be amazed, the connectivity around there. And the home's actually a reseller of the vouchers.
Okay.
So people it's creating a bit of enterprise, creating a bit of employment.
And an opportunity to sell other things while those people
exactly.
are there.
Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of the spaza shops, you know, when we put, the operator put a hotspot at a school, he says, no, bring it here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want them sitting over there. And also, putting a hotspot at a school, it's all right connecting the school.
Mm.
But in the afternoon, the kids all go home.
Mm.
And they need connectivity at home to complete their schoolwork. So that is very much a lesson learned as well, saying, don't put the hotspots at the school. Put them outside or in the areas where they live.
Yes.
So that they can get that connectivity. And the nice thing with creating it with the billing platform that we propose and offer is the billing is done per device. So it's very much exactly the same as a mobile network, where people can buy a voucher on a daily basis or a monthly basis. It's all prepaid. And they can even enter the voucher into a smart TV inside their home or a desktop.
Mm-hmm.
So it provides you with that Wi-Fi connectivity on a nomadic basis. So you might have, like in Louis Trichardt in Chakorta, we've got 12 hotspots.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere within that 12 hotspot coverage, if you've got a voucher, you've got airtime, you've got connectivity. So you're creating a micro Wi-Fi cellular type environment, which is affordable for those environments, but also it's very low maintenance, very low OPEX, and that one has to consider. You don't need a high skill set to do it, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of this equipment is plug and play, or we'll teach them to do what they need to do,
mm-hmm.
and provide support for them on a remote basis. So it's I wish there was funding to get this crowd. We are working to try and find funders to create a pool, a funding pool, that we can help and support ISPs and smaller SMEs in these areas to get them up and going, but also make sure that they spend the money wisely, you incubate them, and you help them commercially on how to monetize that network.
Before I let you go, let's talk about a bit about where this technology is going.
Okay.
You were chatting before we started recording about what Carlson Wireless is busy working on.
Well, yes.
Tell us a bit about what we can expect in the next few years from TV White Space.
I think we're privileged to be involved with Carlson Wireless, who are one of the pioneers of TV White Space. And at the moment, we're still operating on the third generation, which was out in 2017 odd, and a couple of iterations and improvements and efficiencies of it. But obviously, with the whole movement towards Wi-Fi 6 chipsets now, Carlson are strongly considering, and it's part of the plan. We'll see some good news in 2023, more towards the middle of the year, where they're going to now incorporate the Wi-Fi 6 technology with TV White Space. It'll bring the cost right down, but also provide you with much better throughput on the existing TV White Space channels, which is what
is
we
this
want.
Wi-Fi from the base station or Wi-Fi
no,
in the
it's
CPU?
It's Wi-Fi. It's actually using the Wi-Fi 6 protocols, and you've got much higher MIMO, you've got much higher modulation, so your throughput, etc. You're going up to 300 megabits per second on a single channel, compared to the 30. So you're almost 10 times what you're doing.
But using Wi-Fi spectrum?
No, using the TV White Space.
Using TV White Space spectrum.
But using the protocols, etc., within Wi-Fi.
Right.
So it's interesting without giving away too much.
Right.
But I think that's going to change the game, particularly also bring the whole cost into more like your fixed wireless 5 gig type technology, but give you that throughput at the further distance.
Same time.
Which has been a challenge up to now.
Okay, fantastic.
So it's exciting. It's looking very exciting. And we look forward to seeing it. And we're talking about by mid-2023.
Keith, I hope I hope there is a lot more funding coming for TV White Space projects. It almost sounds criminal that there isn't more funding happening. And and hopefully someone from USASA is watching this as well. And maybe some money gets directed towards some of these projects, because we know there's a crying need for connectivity in rural areas. And
Definitely. We canvassing all around, internationally, local, potential funders, potential opportunities. And as I said, a lot of the funders find it risky. They don't know who this SMME ISP is, unknown, starting up. So we try to provide that confidence for the funding that this is possible, this is the business model, and we will assist in making sure that it works and that they are. But the big thing is you're incubating and you're training people in these communities that they can be self-sufficient and run a network and make it something that is passionate within the community. Mm-hmm. Because we've seen how people get so excited when they've got connect. As they say, data is the new gold or the oil.
Yeah. So if anyone is interested in maybe getting in contact with you and talking about this technology and funding opportunities, etc., what is your email address?
My email address is Keith, K-E-I-T-H, at indigobroadband.co.za.
Easy enough. Keith Pitou is a CTO of Indigo Broadband. Thank you for a fascinating discussion.
Thanks very much, Duncan. Thanks for the opportunity, and look forward to keeping in touch with you. And thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.